Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, your weekly cable from the culture trenches, where the troops are just dotting the I's of some cute but devastatingly satirical placards before mounting the barricades, and certainly not hiding, no sir. And we'll be heading into the woods with the artist builder who's making those yearly consumption carnivals, music festivals, a little bit less harsh on the planet. But first, how do invented languages help us talk about painting? Owen McHugh is a Berlin-based Irish artist who's been exploring the world's invented languages and how they might relate to what happens each day in the studio. McHugh's latest Dublin show of paintings and drawings takes its title, Loye Yellow Lasu, from the sole three words for colour in the invented language of Toki Pona. In mid-vernissage, McHugh came to Culturefile Towers to talk a few words of Toki Pona and a smattering of Hildegard von Bingen. Lingua ignota.
My name is Owen McHugh. I am an artist born in Dublin and now based in Berlin. Berlin's an incredible city. I haven't seen much of it, to be honest, for the last year. My little daughter is 11 months old, so I've been playing peekaboo with her for the last while and also playing peekaboo with my gallery for the past few months working towards this exhibition. So between one or the other, I'm busy out, but it's a really beautiful place to live. I moved from Wicklow. I was living on the top of a little hill there in the middle of nowhere, a really gorgeous place. Took a while to beat the Wicklow out of me, but I love Berlin.
The title of your show gives people a clue as to what your interest in languages might be.
Now I'm going to mispronounce this, but
that's the thing. Is there any? If this is an invented language, are there any mispronunciations?
There are actually. I think the language is Toki Pona. It's actually set up in terms of pronunciation that it goes with the international phonetic kind of standard, but that still doesn't mean I'm going to pronounce it correctly.
But you've taken three words from that language.
That's right.
And they're the title for the show and also one of the pictures.
I'm going to try to pronounce it. Loye Yellow Lasso. That means red, yellow and blue or green. So they're the only words for colour in the language.
Why is that?
The language is invented by Sonia Lang. She was going through a period of depression and she really wanted to try to simplify her approach to the world and her way of dealing with other people. She really wanted to narrow things down, so she really wanted to be able to express complex ideas through the simplest possible means. So, for instance, besides the colour, then there's also numbers. So she only has words for one, two, and many. I think, again, that just shows she was trying to limit things as much as possible because, let's face it, I mean, there are plenty of... I think the English language has 1 to 2 million words and the average person has a vocabulary of maybe 20,000. So really we could afford to reduce things down a little bit and especially to clarify your way of dealing with the world and with other people, it's really nice to kind of narrow things down. One of the things I really like about invented languages is the fact that they are essentially daft. People want to kind of rewire themselves to the world and not the other way around. And they try to really put their own ideas first. And I think that's kind of wonderful. So it says a lot more about the creator of the language than it does maybe about the world a lot of the time. Though this is one of the examples of an invented language that some people have actually taken up with it. So there are people that communicate with it. There aren't very many who do it. And I don't think there are any shops that you can go to and speak in that language.
You did find that there is a kind of tradition around invented languages that goes back to the Middle Ages.
Hildegard von Bingen is somebody I'm a real fan of. She's a 12th century abbess from Bingen. I've been a fan of her kind of mystical writings, her compositions. She was a pioneer of the morality play and really an incredible woman at the time. But she invented her own language, lingua ignota. She didn't write explicitly about her reasons and there are only kind of fragments of the language left. So the hypothesis that surrounded then are kind of, on the one hand, political. So she was involved in a lot of the religious kind of controversies of her time, or certainly some of them. She had dealings with popes and various other people. And it's thought that maybe, especially as a woman in power in the church at that time, she needed to be kind of secretive. And if there was anything that she wanted to say, which may have been in any way unorthodox, let's say, then it would have been great for her to have her own special language. On the other hand, she was a mystic and a very creative person. And, I mean, on the other end of the scale, you could say maybe that this was a mystical language for her to better understand God, to better talk to God or talk to people about God. There are a few different kind of historical moments when invented languages became very popular. At one point, for instance, when mathematical language became much more precise, where equations were used instead of verbal descriptions. There was a huge advance scientifically across Europe at the time, and people had the idea that it would be possible to do the same for spoken and written languages. So to really clarify things, make them much more precise. There was a universal language from John Wilkins, so that's the late 17th century. What he did, it's really fascinating, but he tried to have a way of systematizing all concepts. And he was a forerunner for the thesaurus, for the kind of taxonomical categorization of Linnaeus and things like that. So he really set up the whole world into his own categories and had various subsystems and organized this.
It's all his fault then, is it?
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have him on the one hand. There were other people at that time who decided that they'd use numbers for words. Cave Beck, a little bit before Wilkins, actually, used numbers to assign to concepts. So number one is to abandon, number two is to abash. And he goes on from there, and then you just get these lists of numbers. And, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. There's no way really to use it as a language, the same as with Wilkins. But it's still kind of, they led to some other things. In the 19th and 20th centuries, there were a lot of examples of people who really wanted to have world peace and who saw language as being a kind of a fundamental reason for conflict between nations, between people, between the sexes. So really the 20th century is a huge kind of time for peacekeeping languages, let's say. AUA, or lowercase a, uppercase UI, this language by W. John Vilgat. He was a psychoanalyst and a philosopher. He was trained in both, had doctorates in both, and he started off in Vienna, then went to the States. He wanted a language which would he could use in analysis. Also, he saw the language as being able to do so many things. So to create peace, to dissolve selfishness, to align the unconscious and the conscious mind, and really whiten your teeth, do everything else. But he was really, really hopeful. And so many of these language inventors really wanted to do really dramatic things. Vilgart, he used this language with his patients in therapy. So they would essentially free associate with the language, and this was supposed to unlock their unconscious and emotional conflicts, hidden trauma and so on.
Is that currently used?
No. So it really fell out of favour very quickly. And Vilgart was the only one who was actually doing that. I don't think he had any adherents, any followers who kept up with that. I mean, it's a kind of strange way to try to communicate with anyone. So to learn a new language, to go to therapy, I don't think he had many people who had signed up for that. I think there are a number of cliched ideas when it comes to language and visual art. So there are, for instance, people talk about visual language very kind of simply. And if you were to think, so for example, we could go along and see a show in the Chester Beatty Library of 13th century Persian miniatures, and you could really relate to what's going on, see something humanly meaningful. It's a common figurative languages, which I say language again, but a figurative form, which essentially hasn't changed in a long time. So we can really get something from that. But if you're shown a poem in the original Persian or Turkish or what have you by Rumi, all you can do is, I assume you're not fluent in ancient Persian. All you can do is look at the pretty script. So I think, I mean, that's a simplistic example, but I think to talk about visual art as a language or a body of languages, I mean, it can be really instructive, but I think to see a direct parallel is problematic.
Where does your own interest in these invented languages emerge? I mean, you, as a painter, you have another language. Maybe it's related to that, is it?
Directly, how I got to this subject was I was having a problem titling. So I always find that such a difficult thing to do. I mean, as a painter, or if you're working a sculptor or what have you, then you can spend a lot of time in the studio doing something purely visual. At the end of the day, you have nothing to talk about when you go home. I added a little bit of green to the painting today or whatever. I mean, it can be very limited. And titling then is just another part of that for me. Some of the work I do take a long time. And to try to sum it up then, there are kind of standard tropes used within the art world. So you have the kind of the laconic description, woman in red hat, or you have a lot of artists use song lyrics.
Not to mention the classic untitled.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, the dreaded untitled. I was really trying to find a better way to deal with things than that.
You were talking about avoiding artistic tropes, so, you know, maybe I'm about to jump into one. Say you're working on something more elaborate and it's a painting, mm-hmm. that you are kind of talking to yourself mm-hmm. as you work, mm-hmm. and that sort of relates to the invented language, because what you're doing in front of yourself is a kind of internal monologue, but mm-hmm. created visually. Mm-hmm. Is that a painterly trope? I guess it is, yeah.
It is, but it's one that it's important to look at, because there are not many people in the art world that really come up with new languages or anything like it. I mean, it's generally kind of a slowly evolving form. As you work, I mean, it's really difficult to describe. You are thinking purely visually, so it's a parallel form of communication. I don't want to say parallel language, but it's definitely a parallel form. And instead of translating your world through verbal language, you're translating it, in the case of oil painting, for example, into colour and into brush marks, into kind of certain movements. So you have to, these movements and colours have to make some kind of sense of your experience, which can be relayed to somebody else. Again, my language fails me when it comes to talking about painterly language and painterly tropes, but I guess that's why I paint.
I was talking Toki Pona there with Owen McHugh, and his show, Lawyer Yellow Lasso, is at Dublin's Curlin Gallery until December. And next on the Culture File Weekly, we're rewilding the festival. Christy Collard is an artist and builder. He first came to international attention as the man who constructed the garden with which rewilding evangelist Mary Reynolds won a gold medal at Chelsea. But Collard also directs his green build philosophy to the music scene, especially summer outdoor music festivals. As Collard told Culturefile's Louis Scully, he's been looking at ways to ameliorate the impact of building entire cities in the Irish countryside each summer, dedicated to entertainment.
My parents moved to Ireland from England in 71, and they were getting away from what they felt at the time was a world that was falling to pieces. Their aspiration was to live happily and peaceful on an acre of land and have kids and have a small homestead farm. So yeah, we had, you know, we had a milking cow, and we had a donkey and car for transport, and we had pigs and goats and sheep and ducks, turkeys, geese. I'm Christy Collard. I live down here in Bantry in West Cork, and I grew up around Kilkill, and my family business is Future Forests. We sell plants, trees all around the country. They get packaged up and sent off in courier, and people come here and they can buy what they want as well. A lot of the service is about understanding the customer's land, what their needs are, and giving them the best advice possible and trying to supply the right plants to the right people. My dad was very much involved in forestry. They decided to set up this business, Future Forest, to get more involved in reforesting Ireland with a mix of plants. At that time, the only forestry that was happening was the blanket sika spruce in the mountains and on the bogs. My dad was promoting planting mixed diverse woodlands and forests with lots of different species. Part of his strategy was to set up a sawmill to try and encourage people seeing the value in different species of trees and create local industry and jobs around the different trees. I built the first screen build permanent stage in the Bodysole area for the Electric Picnic in 07, and that's still being used to this day. At the time, it was more that I just had the skills and had the ideas and just wanted the opportunity to try them out. These stages I build, they would usually be built from either windfall or trees that needed thinning from an estate. I would develop a relationship and a trust with the estate owners and managers, and I would help them managing their woodlands and forests. It would basically be just built from very locally resourced materials, and I'd use a lot of kind of round timber, and it looks more natural, and it would have an earth roof. And the living roof means that, you know, you still have nature and insects and wildlife happening on top of the roof. The ideology behind creating sustainable green build structures for entertainment and for events, the actual reality of that has only kind of really kind of dawned on me afterwards, and that, you know, once you build it and it's there and it sort of fits harmoniously in the landscape, and it means that every year you're not having to wheel in steel structures. So it has a very low footprint, it's a very low carbon footprint. And I feel that when people see it, it can sometimes inspire people to think about what we can do by utilising our natural resources to create the infrastructure we need to live in. I got the opportunity to conceptualise and develop an area in the All Together Now Festival. I was offered this piece of what would have been a garden once upon a time, but it was completely overgrown with laurel and with some beautiful enormous trees kind of dotted around. The first site visit was quite a vague kind of discussion about the different things that I could have come on board or got involved with. And we stepped inside the edge of this piece of wilderness that hadn't been kind of, I'd say no one had really walked in there for maybe 50 years or 100 years. It was a thicket, completely overgrown. I spent 4 hours crawling through bush and managed to find a fallen tree, and I climbed up this fallen tree. And I could see a clearing around me, and I was like, okay, this is the spot, and I'm gonna use this fallen tree as this part of the stage. So I came back with the concept and went in there with two lads, and we hacked at the bush for a while and then started guarding the edges. A lot of times when you're creating an area, you're thinking about what are you gonna bring in there? But this was the opposite way around. It was like I was taking it out and then leaving behind trees and different bushes that were gonna be beneficial to the area. So gardening the edges of it, and then created this clearing and built the stage, and that's how Global Roots was born.
And it stays there now?
Yes. So this stage will be there for the foreseeable future, and I have plans to add a couple of new areas as well into that area, so a couple of new spaces, an enclosed space, and the seed has only just been sown, so I won't say too much about it.
Christy Collard there, saving the planet one festival at a time. The reporter was Louis Scully. Now, Artisanal data, is that a thing? One of the folksiest tech companies, the online scrapbooking site Pinterest, has been making some adjustments to how it works and what users see when they visit. The changes aim to give people transparency about why certain things are being presented and allow them tweak how the site sees them. But does this welcome in a new era of control in the face of massive data and its opaque use? Our regular Techsplainer and Pinterest early adopter, Professor Aisling Kelleher, was clearly the one to turn to for answers. Is Pinterest really the best company on the internet? That's the question posed by their new refinements to their algorithm.
Maybe it's one of the least worst companies on the internet. I mean, obviously lots of companies on the internet are terrible. But Pinterest is definitely trying to position itself as a kind of a kinder, gentler, more human-oriented social network that has this idea that it's a way to share ideas, like ideas about, you know, ways to decorate your home or recipes or, you know, nothing particularly nefarious. And it really kind of took off about 10 years ago when one of the kind of founders of Pinterest went to a women's blogging and influencer conference. And people were like, oh, actually, that's a really nice way to kind of create and curate content together, like by pinning images essentially onto what becomes your kind of your interest board. You can imagine like an online scrapbook in some way if you have particular interests. Like I joined Pinterest a long time ago when I decided I would become a gardener. So it's incredibly aspirational because I am not a gardener still, but I have lots of images of successful gardens, similar to the way you might buy Martha Stewart's magazine and kind of imagine this other life of yours. But the way Pinterest works is essentially you join it. It is that you kind of have to join it and set up. And it just asks you a few simple questions initially about like what age you are, your gender, and it can work out where you are in the world and the type of language that you speak. And then it will begin to also maybe use your browsing history a little bit to suggest pins for you. And pins are essentially just images of that relate to some of your interests. So it could be, like I said, it's cooking, it could be makeup, and it could be DIY, it could be, you know, Japanese motorcycles, whatever it is. I mean, it goes from the very generic and, you know, large scale, like food, to something really, really kind of micro niche.
Despite not having kind of speech so much, it had it has a sort of friendly atmosphere somehow that's generated through just images.
Pinterest have been one of the companies, even going back as far as 2012, who really took a proactive stance in deciding what content would and would not be allowed on the site. And they are a company that tend to listen in particular to their power users, because obviously this, they have to make money, right? And so they went public this year. They're doing quite well. Their stock price is one of the few of a tech company that actually went up. Also, they have taken some fairly, you can almost take it a provocative stance in response to things, for example, of people initially in 2012 were putting anti-vaccination information up on Pinterest, and the CEOs and the companies decided, no, we're just going to outright ban that. And they have taken fairly provocative steps, you know, given that this is an American-based company and the hoo-ha about First Amendment rights and the kind of totally different stance that Facebook is taking, for example. Pinterest has decided, no, we have a particular stance that we want to take about things ranging from anti-abortion advocates to things like the anti-vaccinations to what they're trying out essentially that they started last week, which is actually giving some power and agency back to the user in a way that they can begin to hone their own feed. And I think that's a very, you know, provocative stance in some ways, given that many of the other large companies, the Facebooks of this world and the Twitters, are very regressive in this context and are very non-transparent about how their algorithms work, whereas Pinterest is taking the opposite stance. You know, for Facebook and other companies like that, they really don't want you to know how the algorithm works. And they really are, I mean, one provocative way you could think of it is that they are actually censoring content because they don't show you everything that you could possibly see. They are curating it and like amplifying certain voices. And of course, other types of algorithms will amplify the things that are loudest, okay, the things that are at the extremes rather than kind of the more mundane everyday. And I think that's where Pinterest kind of has this middle ground, that it is about these fairly tame, I guess, in some ways, interests that people have or ideas. But they are giving people to say, you know what, yeah, your interests change and evolve over time. You finish projects. You know, I might be in a complete tizzy trying to work out how I'm going to, you know, cook my turkey at Christmas time. But like 2 days later, I don't want to start keep getting recommendations for how to cook the perfect turkey. So that's kind of a very silly example. But more broadly as well, you know, tragic things can happen. Like Facebook had a controversy a couple of years ago when they just foisted this year in review on people towards the end of the year that was like, hey, look at this. This was a great year for you. And showing people images or videos of things that had had the most engagement, but were things like the death of a child or your house breaking down. So this sense of these mistakes, I think you can go in and tune that yourself and you can be like, I'm no longer interested in that. I don't want to see that. That reminds me of, you know, an ex of mine, or that reminds me of I left that company because I never want to see those people again. So they are really trying to show people in some sense, you're like, I don't remember why I pinned that. And you can actually click on it and begin to see the rationale behind why that thing shows up in your interest. And if you hide it, they are interested in that. And you're like, I don't want to see that anymore. The algorithm will then take that into effect and begin to kind of fade out the kind of the emphasis on that particular interest that you maybe previously had.
The reason that happens, of course, is that the companies are all about your engagement. The algorithm for engagement tries to get as many eyeballs as possible on the piece of content, or the find the piece of content that will attract the most eyeballs. And that has a kind of moral ambivalence.
I think Pinterest has been quite careful about this, or they're trying to thread a needle, basically. They are mindful that they may lose some users over this because they log on and they're not seeing as many diverse things, and maybe even the level of engagement will go down. But they're rolling this out carefully, and they have done quite a bit of testing with users and haven't seen much fall off.
Is it like a phase in data that we've seen it in beer, where, you know, the product became incredibly corporatized and then there was space for artisanal data?
It seems very millennial, the idea. It has to be, it's very, very special. I'm like, no, it's just lots and lots of data about you and the things that you like. I think maybe Pinterest tries to make people feel special in some way about like their skill in collating and collecting and putting something together in an aesthetically pleasing way. It's more like, I think, less artisanal and more like it's like a power sharing agreement in some ways, whereas they maybe give you 5% of the power. And honestly, that just feels that's enough right now, because if you see the outcome from that straight away, a bunch of stuff drops off my field and I don't get recommended that and the search results are changed. That is quite helpful and useful and might make me engage more with that community than I would have otherwise with the other ones, where I'm like, well, they don't really, I'm just another piece of data to them, as opposed to I'm a human that they're trying to give agency to.
Professor Aisling Kelleher there from her desk in Virginia Tech, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more folksy data next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, Tower Pona.